During the 9 years Anatoly Sharansky was locked up in Soviet prisons and labor camps, the authorities never broke his will. He refused to offer information or sign false confessions. Sharansky was a leader of the movement to allow Soviet Jews to emigrate to Israel. He applied for an exit visa in 1973 when he was 25 years old. Sharansky was also a founding member of the Helsinki Watch Group, a group of refuseniks and dissidents who documented human rights violations in the Soviet Union. Sharansky was arrested by the KGB in 1977 and convicted of treason and espionage. His wife, who had emigrated to Israel, began an international campaign for his release. He became a symbol of Soviet anti-Semitism. When Soviet authorities released him from prison and expelled him from the country in 1986, he joined his wife in Israel. There he changed his name to Natan. Natan Sharansky has just written a book about his imprisonment in the Soviet Union. It's titled Fear No Evil. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. Sharansky writes that he grew up in the Soviet Union unaware of Jewish culture, history, and religion. I asked him if there was a turning point when he started to feel he wanted to become more Jewish.
For me, I was always aware that I'm Jewish simply because there was a word in my identification card of my parents, and as a Jew, and as a result, you were subjected to anti-Semitism. So my Jewishness for me, as for all other Jews of my generation, had very negative meaning, that you are Jewish because there is anti-Semitism. I think the first time when you really realized that it can be also the source of pride was 1967, when the victory of Israel against their enemies, who tried to destroy it, changed the atmosphere, and suddenly you see that even anti-Semites who probably treat you with the same hatred at the same time have much more respect to you. And suddenly you understand that that state is struggling not only for its right to exist, but also for your dignity. And you want to know more about that people, that history, that culture which unites you with that state.
Once you applied to emigrate to Israel, and once you became an activist, did you expect to be imprisoned?
Well, because every person in the Soviet Union who expresses any views, national, religious, political, ethical, which are not approved by the authorities, if he is not too naive or too stupid, must understand that he can be a victim of the regime. And of course, the moment you started openly to struggle for your right to leave, and when you became a spokesman of the movement, Jewish immigration movement, and this is the moment I had to realize that every day I can be arrested.
You were one of the founders of the Helsinki Watch Group, and this was a group that united both refuseniks and human rights activists. Do you think that your arrest was in part a way to discourage the alliance between Jewish refuseniks and other dissidents trying to create reform within the Soviet Union?
Well, definitely. The KGB doesn't like all types of such alliance. Before arrest, and especially in prison, I saw many times how KGB was using different tactics to make splits between dissidents of different nationalities or religions. Probably it was one of the arguments to arrest me, but I don't think that it was the main argument. The main argument, of course, was to destroy our Jewish immigration movement, to demonstrate that it's part of world Zionist plot against Soviet Union, and on the other hand, to destroy Helsinki watch groups, paralyze attempts of dissidents to check sincerity of Soviet Union and fulfilling their obligations on human rights.
Natan Sharansky is my guest, and he's written a new book about his imprisonment in the Soviet Union titled Fear No Evil. When you were imprisoned, your wife had already emigrated to Israel, and she started an international movement for your release. As badly as you were treated in prison, do you think you would have been treated worse had there not been an international group of people campaigning for your release?
Not only I think so, I'm sure that we have a lot of examples that our fate in Soviet prisons depends fully from the readiness of public opinion of the world to struggle for us. I'll give only one little example. Being in strong confrontation with authorities when they didn't let me to write letters home in prison, I started a hunger strike. And after 110 days of this hunger strike, when I was almost dying, in the last moment they retreated, met my demands, and permitted me to write letters to my mother and my wife. Exactly in the same prison, in the same conditions, with the same hunger strike, 2 years after me, in the times of Gorbachev, 3 years after me, Russian dissident Anatoly Marchenko, my friend, died as a result of the hunger strike. In this case, authorities were much less concerned about public opinion, about reaction of the world, and they permitted him to die, what they couldn't permit me to do.
It would have made them look bad if you died in prison.
Well, they were afraid of the possible complications and consequences of this in the world. And of course, it was a direct result of the struggle which my wife, with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people all over the world, was leading.
When you were in prison, you were given a couple of opportunities to get out. One would have been to make a false confession. And the other was you were offered the opportunity to go out saying that you'd petitioned for health reasons, and you didn't do that either. Let me ask you about the first one. You could have, given a false confession, and then once you got out, recanted and say that you gave that confession just to get out of prison. Why didn't you ever consider doing something like that?
Yes, in the first months of investigation, they were showing me many examples of foreigners and dissidents who, from their point of view, made the right thing, who confessed, then were released, then went abroad and said that all this was wrong. And they were almost pushing me to do this. Why? Because for them, the man who accepted their lies, who became again slave, refused from his right to be free man, is not dangerous. And when I was thinking all this situation, I understood that there are some reasons why, rational reasons, why I cannot do it. First of all, by this I compromise my friends and who will go on this way after me, and my weakness will make them weaker. Second, I will compromise those people in the West who support us, because the only reason why they support, because we have moral power, very strong moral position. And if I help the KGB to destroy this moral position, I compromise also those who support us in the West. And of course, I make easier for KGB to prepare new cases against dissidents. But at the same time, I could always understand that even if these reasons wouldn't exist, or if I somehow could find solution for all these reasons, there was some irrational resistance to make principal compromises with the KGB. I understood that the moment you start compromising with them on this, you again become slave, as I was many years ago. When as a loyal citizen, I had to think one thing, but to say another thing. And since I became free, I didn't want that. I wanted to remain a free person even in Soviet prison.
During the 9 years that you were in prison, you constantly resisted through hunger strikes, through refusing to confess to things that they asked you to confess to. What did you have to find in yourself to find that power to always resist?
Well, I think the most important thing was that I knew the difference between the life of a slave, whom I was a loyal Soviet citizen, and living in double thinking all the time, to say one thing and to do another thing, and to think the third thing, and the life of a free person who says what he thinks, who does what he believes is decent. Since you know this difference, and since you as long as you understand that what KGB in fact wants from you is to turn you back to this life of the slave, and you know that you don't want that life which they propose to you, and that's almost enough. Of course, to resist for all these years, you must build your own world in Gulag, in which you're really free, and to bring in this world all the most important memories of the past. To bring this world all your all the things to which you got accustomed to, whether it is playing chess in your mind, or whether it's some scientific speculations, or whether it's literal heroes and so on, and to bring them and to make them to work for you, of course. So and to protect yourself with the help of irony. But what's important to understand that then Gulag, I as well as other political prisoners, did have our world of freedom. And that what was helping us to resist to the KGB, who was trying to destroy this world and to turn us into slaves again.
The world of freedom that you had was the mental freedom that you had to think and say what you wanted?
Yeah, mental, spiritual, that's the real freedom.
The impression I get from your book is that one of your great tools or even weapons was your wit and your sense of humor. And I want to just read an excerpt from your book. And this is this takes place in prison. And you write, "One day I received a visit from Lieutenant Colonel Malafeev, the head of the prison. 'You must behave better,' he told me, 'or we'll keep you here in the punishment cell.' 'What's wrong with the punishment cell?' I said. 'Someday I'll go to Israel, and people will ask me about the punishment cell in Christopol prison. I must be able to answer them.' 'That's exactly why we must keep you in prison,' he replied, the colonel replied. 'You're always thinking of bad things to say about us to the West.' 'What bad things?' I said. 'Are you saying that conditions in Soviet prisons are bad? That sounds like slander.'" That's the kind of typical back-and-forth conversation that you had with people in prison, kind of wordplay and changing things to make it seem like, oh, that they were saying bad things about the prison. Did that help you, being able to do that?
I think that is one of the most powerful weapons in dealing with KGB. The moment you start dealing with them too seriously, the moment when you treat them too seriously, the moment when the only emotion which you express is anger and you start shouting on them, you become too close to them, too involved in their work with you. So you all the time, it's very important to keep them on distance, to feel not only that you are simply the toy in their hands, but you are almost the director of all this, what's happening, that you can always dictate your own rhythm, and that you can simply laugh on them. And that's so important, that it helps you to live in different world from them and to separate yourself from them. I think that without this, it could be much more difficult for me to survive and to be so strong.
Do you know why you were released?
Nobody can say why. I think if you mean what was the last drop which made Soviet Union to make this decision, but no doubt that I would never be released if there was not such a powerful, strong campaign all over the world, and if before going to prison, I wouldn't marry such a woman as my wife.
I want to talk more with you about your life and your life after prison, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Natan Sharansky, and he's written a book about his imprisonment in the Soviet Union. It's titled Fear No Evil. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Natan Sharansky is my guest. He was a leader in the Soviet movement for human rights and for Jewish emigration. He was sent to prison and became the focus of a major international movement calling for his release. After 9 years, he was expelled from the country in 1986 and emigrated to Israel. He's written a book about his imprisonment titled Fear No Evil. I think about you going to Israel after your long imprisonment, and it was a place that you had looked forward to living in for so many years. You thought of it as a place that you wanted to be your home. But when you got there, you really didn't speak the language, Hebrew, and you really didn't know that much about how the Jewish religion was practiced because you hadn't had the opportunity to actually practice it while you lived in the Soviet Union. I find that an incredible paradox in a way, and I wonder what it was like if you felt both kinship and alienation when you first got to Israel.
I definitely didn't feel any alienation. From the very first moment, I felt that I came home, home in the narrow sense to my wife, and now also we have daughter, but also in the broader sense, that I felt that we are here in Israel like one big family. But of course, people who are dreaming about paradise, and when they really come to paradise, they, I suspect, find out that it's not exactly that place which they imagined. The reality is always different from the dreams, but I cannot say that much more complicated, but I can say that it's less attractive.
In Israel, I think you've felt really divided between devoting your time to your family and to just living your life again and remaining an activist. How have you resolved those poles on your life between family life and activism?
I don't think that I succeeded to resolve this problem fully up to now. But one of the first things which we did, we tried to build high wall between us and the correspondents who wanted to interview us day and night. And I think that, and not only correspondents, but many other people, each of whom wanted piece of us. And it was, I think that many people were maybe angry, were upset, were disappointed, but with the time they understood that we also have the right for our own life. At the same time, I felt from the very first moment, and I feel it up to now, that I cannot be really free and enjoy freedom until those whom I left behind are not free, that we can become free only together. And that's why we, so much time I have to spend out of Israel, traveling all over the world, trying to mobilize people on the struggle for the, to help our brothers in Soviet Union. And my wife, who, since I was released, prefers to travel, understands it and supports it.
There are many different, well, there are several different branches of Judaism. When you were free to actually practice Judaism in Israel, did you want to get a sense of what all the options were before deciding how you were going to practice it and which, whether you would be Orthodox or conservative, you know, how you would practice it?
Well, I don't, I think that living in Israel, it's much less problem than for Jewish life in Israel, it's much less problem than for Jewish life in other places. Everything is, for me, is so integral there and so natural that, of course, I do want to know more about Jews, Jewish life, Jewish religion, and I have meetings with all directions, with representatives of all streams of our Jewish religious life. But I don't feel myself torn apart into different directions. I simply do what is already natural to me to do and don't do what's still not natural. And I try to study step by step a little bit Judaism, the things which I couldn't study before. And if you ask me to what stream I'll belong, I wouldn't be even able to say to you. I think I don't have a need in formalizing this.
Your wife, on the other hand, has become very Orthodox. She had become that while you were in prison. I know there's been a lot of speculation that that could possibly cause tension in the relationship. On the other hand, I know of so many people who are of two different religions altogether, so clearly people can live together with different ways of practicing a religion. So are you both practicing differently, and does that seem perfectly comfortable?
All the problems which are supposed to exist in our family exist only in the newspapers and sometimes on radio. They don't exist in our real life. And one maybe of the upsetting things when you came to the free world was why so many people don't even think that it is impossible for two people who love one another, who get their energy, enthusiasm, power, force from the same source, and only because the ways in which they express their feelings are slightly different, why it can cause problems, why such people cannot live peacefully in one family, in one country, and in one world. And for me, who came from the Soviet Gulag, where we lived in one cell, people of different nationalities, of different religions, of different backgrounds, and sometimes of even different aims, and nevertheless could find common language and could cooperate together in our struggle with evil, it's especially upsetting that you come to the free world and find out that here people understand tolerance sometimes much less than in the Soviet camp.
Natan Sharansky is my guest. Israel is a very, very complicated country, and it's seen by some as being the oppressed and by others as also being the oppressor. I know you are always asked questions about Palestinian rights. You grew up in the Soviet Union and really understood the politics of that country. Being a newcomer to Israel and being constantly asked questions about the politics of Israel, do you feel comfortable becoming a spokesperson, being so new to the country?
Well, that's why I'm so... of course, my experience in Gulag cannot be compared with my experience in Israel life. That's why I'm so careful in in taking position on one another question in the Israel life, and try not to be a spokesman of the issues which I feel I don't still understand very deeply. But one of the things to which I resist always is that automatic parallel which many people make in their questions by comparing the plight of Soviet Jews in Soviet Union, the plight of Arabs in Israel, saying that, in fact, it's the same type of oppression, the same type of human rights problem, and so on. With all my understanding and sometimes sympathy to those involuntary victims of the situation in Israel, I have to say that there is absolutely no parallel between totalitarian state, which is trying to destroy individual, which views that individual is part of the state's property, and democratic society with all its democratic institutions, free press, opposition, parliament, elections, and so on, trials, open trials, and so on, which faces really serious dilemma. It's how to defend its right to exist, how to defend itself in the war against terror, and at the same time, how in those complicated historical situations in which it is, to not to destroy those fundamental principles on which the state was built, and to guarantee human rights to every citizen. And that's the serious challenge which our society really faces.
I believe that a lot of Palestinians have approached you asking you for your understanding and for your support. Do you give them an audience when Palestinians come to you and ask you to hear out their case?
I'll tell you more, that I myself, on my own initiative, approached some of those who were known as moderate Palestinian leaders, and we had some private meetings, and private not only because publicity can harm to this, but but also because when they really said something moderate, and they were saying, why with this point or that point you wouldn't go publicly to Jerusalem Post or some other place, and we'll start at least discussion. I can't say that I agree with this, but we can start discussion. The answer was very sad, that if I tell it publicly what I say you now, tomorrow I'll be killed by one or another extremist from Syria, or the one who'll get orders here in eastern Jerusalem and so on. And that's, I think, the biggest tragedy of Palestinian people, and as the result of us, that during 70 years of this coexistence, those Palestinian leaders who had really courage to say we have to accept their right to exist, we must start negotiations, as a rule, all of them were really killed.
Last week in the Soviet Union, dissident Andrei Sakharov held a press conference in which he praised Perestroika, he praised Gorbachev, and he said that Gorbachev's reform policies were deserving of trust. He also said that his public statement, that Sakharov's public statement, reflects a change in the Soviet Union, not a change in Sakharov. What were your reactions when you heard about that?
First of all, I want to say that I was very close with Andrei Sakharov, and I was helping him in his contacts with press in the times when he couldn't use the facilities of Foreign Ministry of Soviet Union to give this press conference. And of course it shows that something changed. But I want to say that in his support of Gorbachev, and in the support of Gorbachev expressed by many Americans, including in the last days even by President Reagan, there is a big difference. He didn't say that all this is bureaucratic. He did say that the system is still very different. And what's more important, he praised Reagan for his efforts, for his criticism, and said that it's very important to continue criticism of the state. And the fact that he mentioned dissidents who are still in prison, and some of them, the only crime of them is that they said some years ago, when it wasn't permitted, what Gorbachev says today, when it is permitted. And about many of them I write in my book, and they are still in Soviet prison, reminds us that the changes in leadership and the sometimes exciting change in some or other phenomenon in the system doesn't mean the change of the principles of the system. That's why even when we wish that Gorbachev will continue, we must understand that he will go only as far as we in the West will be ready to to demand and to press and to struggle and to criticize. And we mustn't think that we can help to Gorbachev's reforms by being silent.
So you really did a lot of reading between the lines?
Yes, of course. I know very well the way how we in Soviet Union have to read the newspapers, interviews, and so on.
In the last few years, you've had to do something that, of course, you really wanted to do, and that is live in freedom. Is coping with freedom after 9 years of imprisonment a challenge? Were there difficulties in coping with freedom when you...
I'd say so, that coming free from the world of Gulag and adjusting yourself to the free Western world with the attempt to remain free is really not a simple problem, because with the time you notice that you are all the day you are making all kinds of choices which you couldn't make in your previous life. What to drink, what to eat, where to go, what kind of book or newspaper to read, so on and so on. And while in Soviet Gulag you was making every day only one choice between good and evil, to say no or yes to KGB. And then your life was really deep, had some existential depth, and you felt how full it is, how tense it is. And here, lost in all these choices, you suddenly find out that you don't have even time to think, to make some really important choices. And you find out that your life can become more shallow, and as a result, maybe less free. And you also find out that in order to be as free as you were in Soviet prison, you must be ready to say no, not only to your enemies, as it was in Gulag, but sometimes to say no to your friends, each of whom wants part of you. And sometimes to say no to your friend is much more difficult than to say no to your enemy. So all these challenges of the free world, which I have to face every day.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Natan Sharansky, and since his release from prison in the Soviet Union in 1986, he's been living with his wife, Avital, in Israel. He's just written a book about his imprisonment. It's titled Fear No Evil, and it's published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.